Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's episode is a four questions episode. And in this case, we're going to have a filmmaking team answer the four questions, which are favorite films of all time, an underrated film, an overrated film, and a lesser known film that you want people to seek out. So I mentioned we had a filmmaking team today, and today that team's from the UK. They're Varun Raman and Tom Hancock, and those two gentlemen wrote and directed and produced an amazing short call Transmission. If you go to discoverindiefilm.com right now, you can watch it. And whenever I see an amazing film, I'm always curious to know how those filmmakers are going to answer the four questions. And for the record, right after you hear the sci-fi warp engine noise, you'll hear Tom's voice first, then Varun, then me. But at that point, hopefully you can tell Tom and Varun apart.
You always think what you've seen and what you like is so obvious and everyone's going to say it, but not everyone does.
Yeah. It's a bit, it's also, it's sometimes it's difficult because I think there are films we definitely agree on. And then there are films that where we probably have differing answers.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Well, here, who wants to give me their top three favorites first?
Okay. I'll go ahead. It's a favorite of all time. This is hard, so I had to come up with three. So I'm probably a bit similar with Tom on some of these, and I think I might differ on the third one. But first one is Underground by M.A. Kusturica. So I think it's from 1995, about the history of the formation and the disintegration of Yugoslavia, essentially. But it's one of the greatest satires. It's the filmmaking is of the highest order. Just the energy of it, and it's 4 hours that doesn't feel like 4 hours at all. I just really, really, really love this film.
And it's one 4 hour film. It's not two parts.
That's 1 4 hour film, but I think there was a TV show as well. There was a version that was aired on television, and that's like even longer. But yeah, it's really an incredible film. And anyone who likes any kind of Kubrickian satires or anything like that should definitely watch this. It's great. It's very, very good.
This is one where some of our favorite old times are ones that we sort of agreed on.
Sure, sure.
So this one is, I think, maybe the first two, I'm not sure, but definitely the first one on Underground. It's just so colorful and so fun, and it pushes to the max the premise of what you can do with something like this. It really, a friend said to watch it, said that we'd like it, and it's probably the one film that we say to everyone, go away and watch this film. It's a breakdown of the conflict. Begins at the end of the Second World War and the formation of Yugoslavia. And maybe the corruption of it, and then the manipulation of that, and then the destruction of that.
The way we're describing it sounds like it's not that accessible, but I think anyone watching this film would immediately find it accessible. It has such an energy to it and a gusto to it that you do not find in other filmmaking.
It sounds right up my alley. So, and I don't think I've heard of it. So I'm going to try to get a copy of that as soon as possible.
Yeah, there's a song in it that we love as well. Kalashnikov. And it's, there's a lot of brass. There's always this brass band about following them, running along with them and running off with them. And it's just kind of, it's completely hectic. And again, it's, one of the things as we carry on trying to make films and being asked about films that we like and things, is the more we kind of realize what, you know, people say your voice or whatever, but it's lowbrow meets highbrow. Absolutely. It's the meeting of those two.
And I think that's a very good representation of lowbrow meeting highbrow. Definitely. It's probably
excellent. Well, and that's on both of your lists. All right. So give me the next one.
I think this is on both of our lists, so yeah, I'll let you go first.
Okay, well, Network by Sidney Lumet, do you say?
Lumet.
Yeah, I think it is Lumet. Yeah, I don't think you go for the French T.
Yeah. Yeah, we heard Pacino say it once, and we're like, well, that's surely his name. That's Paddy Chayefsky. Did you say that? The writer. So there's a lot of misnomers about with filmmaking, and so people say, number one, it's you need to show and not tell, and that's a good thing to think about occasionally, and to test out your story. But what is mistaken quite often is when you have a lot of dialogue. And when you have lots of dialogue, readers might think that you have you're saying too much obvious stuff, and that maybe your characters aren't actually there's not many actions going on screen. So what Network proves is, it's probably lowbrow meets highbrow. So when these people are talking and they're arguing with each other, there is so much going on in their performances, in their micro expressions. It's like an opera. The actions turn out to be the micro expressions on their faces a lot of the time. And Sidney Lumet is always a filmmaker. So what's his book called?
Making Movies.
That was one of the number one, every filmmaker should watch that book. It's a quick read as well. The number one thing we took away from that was camera plotting.
I think it's how Sidney Lumet works as a director. He's not a director obsessed with legacy about, you know, what kind of films he makes. He makes this type of film, and he doesn't make this. He's not the kind of director to make the same type of film every single time. He very much respects the screenplay, and he works from the screenplay outwards in terms of informing his directorial process. So he's one of the greatest directors because he just completely changes the kinds of films he does. He mixes it up, but his approach always remains constant but true to the screenplay. He's just a fucking great director in almost every sense. But yeah, Network as well, the monologues are great.
It's one of those prescient films as well that foreshadows a time 20 years away and still relevant today, still relevant in the future with network TV.
Howard Beale is it would fit in, you know, the era of Trump very much.
For your third favorite, you guys are going to have separate. This is where you're going to diverge. So, tell me what your third favorite films are.
Go ahead, Ryan.
I'm going for the ones that I've, on reflection, realized I've rewatched the most in my life, and I'm going to cheat and give two films because I think they're from kind of similar filmmakers, but then they diverged and did very different things. But I'm going to go with Pulp Fiction and Boogie Nights at the same time. They're both my third film because I just find myself every time I turn it on the TV, I find it, I can jump right into the middle of any of these films and watch them through to the very end, and they can somehow be a source of comfort for me, a source of familiarity, and I just can't ever get bored of either of these films.
Oh, and those are two fantastic films. Yeah, both films, no matter where you come in, you have to watch to the end, and they're flawlessly made.
Aesthetically, I think the youthful energy of them as well is encapsulated. They're two very lucky filmmakers that I'm jealous of that got to make films of that scale, you know, at that age as well. Like, in particular, Thomas Anderson, the exuberance of a 27-year-old making that film that sincerely is incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny. I mean, I love those filmmakers too. And it's funny because I would if I picked my favorite of each of those guys, those wouldn't be the films, but I get what you're getting at too, that those were the earlier works. Actually, that was number two for both of them. Because I think Tarantino, number one was Reservoir Dogs, and number two was Pulp Fiction. And Paul Thomas Anderson, number one was Hard Eight, and number two was Boogie Nights.
There's something about the second film.
Yeah, the sophomore effort is like they learned what they needed to learn on the first one, and the second one they just nailed it.
Yeah, definitely. And there's that, there is that wanting to prove themselves. You can definitely see those films. The ambition, it is definitely going out of their comfort zone. They're not, they weren't offering more of the same. They're expanding upon it and then throwing a bit of a curveball as well.
It was, yeah, you know. Yeah. And I remember when Pulp Fiction came out, and I had been a huge Reservoir Dogs guy. Saw it in the theaters when it first came out, and thought it was the second coming. And I remember when Pulp Fiction came out, and Tarantino did this interview, and the first thing he said is, "It's just such a movie." And he's like, "I hope you know what I mean when I say, like, Pulp Fiction is just a movie, you know." And both of those really are like movies. I get what he's saying. I like to share that with people who appreciate movies.
It's nice. We need escapism. We definitely need it.
Yeah. And he's talking about the scale and the scope and the storytelling.
Playfulness as well.
Yeah, absolutely. My God, he makes light of anal rape.
one scene that always comes back is the firecrackers scene.
When in Boogie Nights?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Thomas Jane, the friend, the bad friend, who gets him in on a drug deal.
Yeah, I know, and that guy lighting the firecrackers throughout the conversation, freaking them out, that was...
Rick Springfield's playing... yeah, in the background, and that's the best. I think that's the best performance Mark Wahlberg's done. Apart from, I think The Departed was good, but that is just, there's something about that performance.
Absolutely.
He's never been more likable than in that film.
No, my God, so good. All right, well, Tom, what's your last one or two?
Well, I'll probably keep this one on for kind of story technical reasons, and as Tarantino again, God. So, Inglourious Basterds is just I'll also go Doctor Strangelove as well, but Inglourious, they're both kind of a bit vaudeville and quite vignette-y in terms of kind of jumping around into storylines that don't always necessarily link up with each other, but they just they're all kind of going on at the same time and creating a kind of sense of tension the whole time as well. I do love a war film. I mean, I don't think we've particularly got one for the future, but got to have one at some point. But
a war film.
What are you
comparing it to again?
No, I'm just saying the two of them at the same time, but I'm saying in our kind of slate, we haven't got one.
You mean like what, like Inglourious Basterds?
No, just a war film. But
sounds like your sci-fi trilogy is a bit of a war, civil war.
Maybe.
We've got a Men on a Mission movie.
Yeah.
If that is a war film.
Maybe. By the way, Tom, I kind of want to throw in that when Varen says Pulp Fiction, I'm like, Pulp Fiction is amazing, but I think Inglourious Basterds is like Tarantino's apex. Like, I can't imagine a better film.
So we did an article where we wrote a few articles for, it's called The Script Lab, and that's actually where we got our character questionnaires from that really help us out. I think it's still going. It helped us out a lot back a few years ago anyway. So this was a way how we learned to, learned the mechanisms by, we were trying to write articles and see if anybody actually agreed with what we were saying. And one of them was on suspense and I don't know if we actually finished the article. Another candle needs to be lit, but we were going to do two articles. One, it was on the difference between mystery and suspense. We did this one, did we?
No,
we didn't get the suspense one done. One was on mystery. The one on suspense we never got done. But we've got all the workings for it, but we never had the time to do it. But we broke down a number of suspense films. And one of them was Speed. And another one's Inglourious Basterds. And Dial M for Murder, I think, as well.
Yeah. Why they were particularly good suspense films.
So a funny thing is with suspense films, if you ask someone to name a suspense film, they normally name a thriller or something. And normally that thriller is a bit of more, might be a mystery even. They're quite misdiagnosed. So we wanted to know how they work. And suspense is a lot about information that you have. It gives away loads of information, but it makes you care about that information.
You can't obfuscate with suspense. You've got to be completely and not try to withhold any information back. You've just got to give it there and then, because then otherwise it's just mystery.
Yeah. And that's another. You can mix the two up, but this is an all out suspense film, and it's the classic. Is it a Hitchcock and Truffaut conversation? Of, you know, the kids have got a bomb, and that bomb has to go off. It has to blow up, and it's tick, 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 boom. And when you break down Inglourious Basterds, in terms of almost every little scene and the whole arc of it, it really is, you know, the cinema scene at the end as well. That's the bomb. And he just delivers the whole, everything, every promise, every fear. He just delivers on absolutely everything, and it's so much fun. Each character is so full, and it's so irreverent. And that's the same again with Dr. Strangelove. The theme of irreverence, highbrow, lowbrow. It's a little strange. I can't believe that it is a Kubrick film. That shocks me. Does it shock you?
Yeah, it did. I guess you could say that, because it is so.
I wouldn't believe it.
So because the first thing I saw by Kubrick was probably The Shining, and then I went back and saw 2001.
So serious.
Yeah, and then to see, and I think Strangelove might be one of the funniest films ever made.
Yeah.
And just brilliantly funny and dark funny, and like you're saying, highbrow, lowbrow, but it's so smart. And I mean, Peter Sellers was essentially a deity.
Mm. I love the way he does that. He plays each part perfectly.
That's a massive daring joke. It's I kind of postulated this to Vian the other day. People go on about Kubrick being a genius and not holding back on, you know, wanting all of his takes until it was perfect. And I said, well, maybe he was a coward. Maybe he was absolutely terrified, and he never really knew, so he kept on going. Probably he didn't. Probably he did have the perfection seeking after that. But Dr. Strangelove, I mean, maybe he did do hundreds of takes on this one, but it feels so loose.
You know, I start to think, and I have no proof, but I think the whole Kubrick reputation is marred by that last film, Eyes Wide Shut, where he was trying to get a good performance out of bad actors.
We disagree. We really like that.
Oh, you like it. There you go. That's good. That's good.
And if you go deep into it, it's very fascinating.
Well, I don't dislike the film, but I do think there's so many scenes where Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman feel wooden to me. That I do in my mind picture Kubrick saying, do it again, do it again, do it again, just because he's trying to get them to stop sucking. Mm-hmm. But I'm being very biased.
Have you watched that a lot of times? You probably have, I guess.
No, I haven't.
Oh, give it another watch, because it is, because I think one of the problems was the time it came out, they were so big and supposedly sexy, and there was questions about that. But you see this film and you go, oh, so I'm supposed to find these two. This is supposed to be something good, is it? And I think it got a really bad. I think the audiences came in with a bit of a bad attitude.
I think the problem was it seemed like it was going to be sexy. Some sort of horror or thriller.
Well, Kubrick, the bar was so high with Kubrick that. Yeah. I actually went and saw that. I think it was opening night at this big theater in Westwood, where I always went to see premieres, because it was just this. It was the best sound system in Los Angeles, and I'm very shallow now. My review of it would be that, like, somehow a massive sex party shot in 70mm was boring.
I
think it's because it's not about what you
it's not about the sex party
it's going to be about. And I guess we first watched it years after the hype, like a decade at least after. So I guess it, because we were watched it in those circumstances, maybe we weren't expecting anything.
Well, you know what? I trust you, so I will watch it again.
There's a lot of really, really cool motifs in there. I think our article is knocking about, actually. It might be a parallel. I think it's okay. I think the points are in there. Maybe it's a long article, but I think it will be, yeah, it's knocking about in our Power of Madness.
But I have no proof, but I'm almost sure there's no way Peter Sellers put up with, you know, 50, 100 takes. I'm sure that young Kubrick was not indulged like that.
Yeah. This was before. This is pre 2001, so we have to take that into account. But, plus 2001, I think he must have instilled himself with a lot of insecurity in terms of, I need to outdo this in some way, or I need to build upon this in some way. I think.
Yeah, and also, I mean, he made the studios tons of money making an esoteric film with people in ape suits that no one in Hollywood understood, but it made so much money. I think at that point they just said, okay, you can do anything you want because we don't understand it, but you make us money. So you want to make a horror film where a kid rides a big wheel for hours? Fine. Like, just do your, I think he was given complete freedom after that.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, definitely.
And it might not have been a great thing.
I'll probably leave it there with the two of them. Why I love them so much. But
both. I love your list. I think you both named great films.
So I think we got the from agreeing with the first two, we got a couple of cheeky ones in the third one.
So the next question is the underrated one.
Okay, so I'm going to kick this one off because this one always strikes my mind, and I feel like I've lost time because of this. So I love Adam Sandler. I absolutely love him. He cracks me up completely. And so his Punch Drunk Love is the film where you'll say, okay, that's his proof. I'm cheating a bit by saying an actor rather than a film, because Punch Drunk Love is a good film, undeniably good film. But I feel like I've missed out on watching a lot of Adam Sandler films because people have ripped into him so much. But I haven't had a TV. We didn't have a TV for, you go to uni, 18, 19, and I didn't have a TV probably until 28. So we're not having a TV on, the films don't come up. And only recently, we got one. And they just come on the TV and I just record them. And they're really, really funny. Every one of them in some way. And they, people say, oh, you know, kind of mugging its screen and really simple, juvenile, sense of humor. And well, there are some that aren't as good as other ones, but he exactly knows what he's doing. And I've missed out on watching so many of them because other people told me they were bad. Like, oh yeah, you shouldn't watch, what a waste of time. No, I record them and I just watch them and I laugh at them to myself.
They're very good. They're very. I get it. So you're not saying Punch Drunk Love. You're actually just saying Adam Sandler in general.
And a lot of his other films. Like, yeah, there are a few, but don't kind of. I think they're fewer than there are actual good ones. But Waterboy just sold me completely. That's probably one of the films of my all time favorite films. I don't know why. Stupid voice, but he's made a whole career on it.
No, Waterboy is brilliantly funny. I always love to, a non sequitur I like to throw out is I just go, let's call it the knee. when he goes, what part of the snake are we eating? And she's like, snake ain't got but one part. I'd call it the knee. but I think Waterboy, by the way, I think Punch Drunk Love is a really good pick for underrated, because everyone raves about Paul Thomas Anderson films, and that one is so good, and I think it's overlooked because of Adam Sandler, which is unfair because he's great in it, and it's a great film.
If I don't know what Oscar worthy is, but I would say that's Oscar worthy.
It's got gems all over. There's so much filmmaking to learn from.
It's such a physical performance as well. And but I think Adam Sandler's in a weird place right now because, you know, like with Nicolas Cage and Mandy, I think the response to Mandy with Nicolas Cage has been this kind of delayed hipster cred reaction to realizing that Nicolas Cage is good at certain things. Very, very, very good.
He just is good
at certain things. He is good.
I think
he chooses projects indiscriminately, so he ends up being in quite a few bad projects. But when he is in good projects, he's incredible. And like he can be incredible. And I think the same thing is happening with Adam Sandler.
But
I think he will.
Daring actors. Like, you have a flop.
But I think Adam Sandler will get to a point where everyone just retrospectively looks back at his career and they were like, oh, I actually do just really love Adam Sandler. And I think it'll get to a point where he probably can do no wrong. So he might have his Mandy moment.
That'd be nice. And, you know, in spite of the... He does take a real beating in the last 5 years or so. But, I mean, I can name things like 50 First Dates that I thought was just a... I think that film is wonderful. That's just a great, funny, but heartwarming film. Mm. And, you know, people kind of sleep on Hotel Transylvania, but those are good films.
I love it.
And that's from the Sandler Factory, and he's the lead actor of it, even if it's animated.
Like my, we were choosing some, so I do watch a lot of kids, supposedly kids films. That the filmmaking, the writing is just so full constantly. There's a lot of bad ones about. But, you know, when every character in that world has a little kind of joke from the fact that, you know, the world you're in. And we were going through a few that we might watch. And the moment she said that, I just lost it. And I actually ended up watching the last one in the cinema as well, just to honor the whole thing. Because when you watch clips of him playing the character, you know, in the sound studio, it's so, so funny. And you completely forget that it's him as well. I nearly did mention what was – it nearly got on my list, actually. That's a fantastic performance when you think that's his voice. The comedy timing is awesome.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
I'll let Byron give his own,
Underrated films – I found this hard, but I'd say Birth by Jonathan Glazer is a very underrated film. That's regarded as his worst film by lots of people, but I just think it's fucking great and it's beautiful. Can I cheat and do a second one?
Go ahead. There's no hard and fast rules.
The least regarded of his the Apartment trilogy, but I think The Tenant is fucking great by Roman Polanski. Mm. The Tenant is a very, 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 very good film, and it's the most nightmarish of them. I think people look down upon it because of the bad thing. It has an incredibly haphazardly executed dub, but that film just stays with you forever. It's horrible. It's nightmarish, and when you leave the house, it really affects your behavior. It's a real nightmare. But I'd say those two are my two underrated films, definitely.
Definitely. Excellent. I have to see Birth. I haven't seen Birth. You're given now, after this conversation, I'm going to have so many films I need to watch.
Nicole Kidman films, I guess, from the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. I think, again, the reason why that wasn't liked was because people were expecting a different kind of film. This is the guy who just made Sexy Beast and then... that's the inherent problem of marketing a film is it's how do we get people to come see the film? How do we get them to go away and be happy and satisfied with what they actually got?
Oh, so there you go, by the way. Sexy Beast is one of my all-time favorites. I can't get enough of that film. And I didn't even know that Birth was a follow-up of that director.
And then he did Under the Skin as well afterwards, like a decade later.
Yeah.
I think that would fall into
which I did see. But yeah, you know, you think I would have chased down everything Jonathan Glazer does, considering that I can't get enough of Sexy Beast.
He did loads of Guinness adverts as well. He did loads of cool adverts anyway in the 90s. But yeah, he was a very beautiful.
Yeah, and he did. He was a music video guy too, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was just very, very, very good. Always good. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm gonna get a copy of Birth now. All right. Well, now have a little fun. Don't be too nice, because it's the overrated question, which is, you know, by the way, you're not saying it's a bad film. It could be perfectly good. It's just people hold it up as more than it needs to be.
So we sort of are going to be too nice about this. And
you're allowed.
Possibly just not really name one, because not entirely sure it's the film's fault and the filmmaker's fault. Because it kind of comes from a more problem of film criticism. And advertising and marketing and film critics trying to say more about themselves than about an actual film.
I have no problem with it. Actually, I've had other filmmakers have come in and said, you know what, every film is what it is, and a lot of effort went into it, and a lot of artistry went into it. And even if it didn't turn out the way it needed to, there's no reason to criticize.
So the worst kind of filmmaking is purely cynical filmmaking. And
you can get that on, I guess,
top either
level. When it's made just for the money? A studio can get just behind, you know, a studio can get behind a film for different reasons, whether it's for money, whether it's a four-quadrant blockbuster that's just made cynically. There can be four-quadrant blockbusters that are fucking incredible and great entertainment, but then when they make them cynically, it's not so good. And the same with awards contenders films as well. I guess it's the kind of when there are projects when the studio feels like that they can't fail, and then they get overrated because then you're not quite sure whether the criticism of it is an extension of the marketing of the film, or whether it's been down to, I don't know, inviting critics to set visits and cozying up to them well before the film's release. I have no idea. But there are certain films that just seem to get praised unanimously, and then you're just like, why did it deserve this level of praise? those kinds of films are the most disappointing, when it's just like people are telling you, you have to see this, and then you're like, oh, okay.
It's irritating to go to the cinema. What did we see on a week? We saw something on a weekend, and Byron talked me into it, and I generally trust his, he's trying to persuade me or something, but not on a weekend. For some reason, it's kind of arbitrary because my job doesn't really matter whether it's the weekend or not. But if I do have a weekend off and I go to the cinema and I watch something terrible, or not even terrible, but just, so mad. So, so mad. I hate the feeling I've been tricked into the cinema. And yeah, it's just really disappointing. Normally you can spot it, that kind of film, but sometimes you can't, and you've been taken. You've been taken like a mug.
All right, well, anyway, you get a pass. You get a pass on the overrated. I won't even ask you what would they have been, but you can. I mean, you've already named films I haven't seen, but you can... But the question four is the lesser known films that people should seek out.
So, very cool going to, on the film festival, and we went to the Fantasia Film Festival, which is,
2017.
Yeah. Very cool. Very fun. And so we've been lucky enough to actually, see quite a lot of cool feature films, because they actually give you tickets to go to everything, and you get kind of the speedy queue, which is amazing because you learn so much about
being in an audience, and especially at Fantasia, because they really they've got a real special audience there, and they love subversive films, films that really mess with the audience, and they say they're going to go this way and they go that way, and you know, when they're very receptive, and you really feel like you're on a roller coaster ride in that audience. Very, very cool. So we do have a couple of modern, lesser known films that are to watch out for. So we can say those. And I guess we've got a few kind of like old ones as well, because there's always some old ones knocking about. But for a couple of modern ones, the first one that came to my mind was Assholes.
By Peter Vak. He's like a bit part. He has a bit part in Mozart in the Jungle, I think, in the first and second season. But he directed and acted in this film.
He pays for this, his directing films, by acting, a bit like kind of John Cassavetes for now. But so the film's called Assholes.
Nothing like John Cassavetes in terms of directorial style.
I haven't heard of Assholes.
It's a vulgar film in every sense, and it's like, was it like John Waters meets Bret Easton Ellis
and Woody Allen?
That kind of it's vicious. It's
I'd say John Waters meets Woody Allen. I
think Bret Easton Ellis as well is a good
caustic,
forgiving tone.
You've been listening to a lot of Bret Easton Ellis, so I'll give you that. So as soon as we got off the plane and we got picked up, we were asking them. What are the hot tips? And they were saying Assholes. So we went there, and it's just vulgar.
It's as vulgar as the title.
So yeah, so brother and sister, probably because he plays the brother in it as well. So a lot of family in it. His sister is Betsy Brown.
The actress. She's very,
so
very
shameless
good.
In it. She's absolutely. She'll surely become something massive.
She's like a young Amanda Plummer.
if you can find a shameless actor, and especially an actress, it's absolute gold. We're always looking out for them. Her life's falling apart. They all have psychologists and therapists, so brother and sister live with each other. She tries to go clean, doesn't last very long, and then she ends up hanging out with her brother's friend. And then they get addicted to poppers. And from then on in, they just get more and more hedonistic and act out in family occasions when not supposed to. And they're both addicted to, I don't know, anal play, let's say, more broadly.
There's a demon involved.
It's kind of low budget. He really knows his moments, and he really knows messing around, and it feels quite improv.
I think it would piss off a lot of people on our recommendation. It's that kind of film that quite a few people would be pissed off if they went off and watched this.
It's pluralism. Film pluralism. This is the thing. This is a bit of a. Yeah, we need to have these films because it looks like it was surely quite low budget to make and just so much fun.
It's got a very unique outlook on the world, and I think it's we need more of that, I think.
Definitely. Yeah, again, totally irreverent.
Well, it's funny because of, you've, like I said, there's been several films you've named that I want to hurry up and see. And show the girlfriend, because she's a film fan as well. But I actually think I should need to start with Assholes, because we're particularly vulgar people.
Oh, you love it. Yeah.
Everything you've said just makes it sound like, a wonderful film. And I grew up on John Waters and the early, the early Pedro Almodovar films. Wildly vulgar and wonderfully entertaining.
I think we need more of it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Definitely. If we had Pink Flamingos in the 70s, we should have something much riskier than that today.
Well, have you guys seen Pepe, Lucy, y Bomb?
No. What's this?
It's the first Pedro Almodovar film.
Okay. I've watched lots of these now.
And Just see it. You were each supposed to get your own lesser known to seek out.
You want to do that one?
Well, the other one from Fantasia that we saw was Dread, which is a really cool meta documentary / reconstruction. It was a very weird film about this. It's from a Norwegian director who made a film about a stand-up comedian who was famous in Norway for filming prank videos, where he would provoke people on the street and then he would get hit by them. And then he became some sort of viral star. And I think an energy drink in the US hired him to be the head of his their marketing campaign for their energy drink. And then basically this film is called Drib, because this Drib is the fake name of this energy drink company, an actual real energy drink company that I think that they would have got sued for if they named. So they make a reconstruction with the actual stand-up comedian, and they film reconstructions of his experience in LA and this promotional campaign with this energy drink company and how strange it is. And Brett Gelman, who's a good actor, he's in lots of stuff now. He plays.
And he's a great stand-up.
Yeah, he's fucking great in this, and he plays a really sleazy boss, of course, in this, and he's very good. And it's a very interesting film.
He's like an advertising guru. Advertising guru.
But it's fucking great, and it's a really good film, and it went under the radar. And I don't know. It's just a very good film.
It's about cynicism, isn't it? Hmm. Just again, right. Advertised cynicism.
Oh, cool! It's on Prime Video, so I can watch it. And you know what? I did watch it. I think it was that night or the next. Instead of watching what was on the DVR, we threw Drib on Amazon Prime, and Varen and Tom did not let me down. Their lesser-known recommendation, something they saw at a film festival that I'd never heard of before, was a pretty cool, very original film. Now, based on their excellent taste in film, I really do hope you watch Transmission. You can go to discoverindiefilm.com and watch it right now. And that's actually the business I'm supposed to add at the end of every podcast. Discoverindiefilm.com has tons of great short films on it, and it also has links to great feature films. Every film, of course, has an interview with the filmmakers for you to listen to after you see their film. And besides discoverindiefilm.com, on the social media front, it's DIF Wins. It's at DIF Wins on every platform. And there's a fun story behind that, but whatever, it's at DIF Wins. And as always, I just want to mention that the Sherman Oaks Film Festival is every November, and Film Invasion LA is every June. They're both great festivals. The films keep getting better. It keeps getting harder to get them all in. But you know what? It's a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. Yeah.